As a young man, Christian Piccolini was in a white supremacist group, but he walked away, and now he's trying to get other men to do the same.
I think I'm living proof that somebody can change. I didn't start out as a racist. I became a racist for 7 years. So I wasn't born that way. So I did change from being a non-racist to a racist back to a non-racist.
We revisit our conversation with Christian about his Chicago-based organization, Life After Hate, plus how expectant parents can help make sure their pets are ready for the new baby.
There are lots of changes that are coming with lots of the things that that dog is going to have to get used to that's going to be possibly stressful for the dog. So the most important thing they can do is start planning and preparing way in advance.
And the Urbana-based Jupiter String Quartet joined us in studio.
I think audiences, when you see chamber music live, you really pick up on the way we're interacting on the stage. Unfortunately, we can't bring the volume that an orchestra brings, but I think we bring intimacy and dynamic communication.
That's all coming up on this encore edition of The 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to The 21st. I'm Scott Cameron, in for Nyla Boodoo. Christian Piccolini wasn't born into a Klan family. His upbringing in Blue Island, just outside of Chicago, doesn't seem like one that would make him turn to white supremacist groups. But as a troubled teen and then into his young adulthood, he was an active skinhead. After he found his way out, he started speaking about his experiences, and he founded a group, Life After Hate, that helps people leave white supremacist organizations. Before former President Obama left office, his administration gave Life After Hate $400,000 in grant money, but in June, the Trump administration slashed all of that funding. Earlier this year, Christian talked with host Nyla Boodoo about his organization's funding situation and shared his own story about how he walked away from being a skinhead.
Christian, you helped start Life After Hate because it was so difficult for you to leave your former life in being a skinhead. But before we get to that, I feel like people probably want to know, how did you first get involved in all of this?
You know, I was kind of like just any other teenager. I was searching for three very important things that most young people search for, and that is a sense of identity, sense of community, and also a sense of purpose. And at 14 years old, I was a little bit lost. I had been marginalized and bullied quite a bit because of my parents being immigrants and not really fitting in, and also being pretty shy. When a man one day walked up to me when I was standing in an alley at 14 years old smoking a joint, and he came up to me, and the man had a shaved head and boots, and the year was 1987. And he walked up to me and he grabbed a joint from my mouth and he looked me in the eyes and he said, "Don't you know that that's what the communists and the Jews want you to do to keep you docile?" And I was 14 years old. I didn't quite know what a communist was or if I'd met a Jewish person at that point, and hardly knew what the word docile meant. But I was suddenly struck with this man who is twice my age and his charisma and his ability to talk to me as an adult and not tell me that smoking pot was bad for me like my parents would tell me, or that it was stupid, or what would other people think. But he seemed to give me a reason that other people were trying to control me through this. And I started to listen and very quickly became indoctrinated into the racist propaganda.
So you had about 7 years of this, right, Christian? I know you and I have talked about this a lot in the past, although not here on air on the 21st. You had moments during those 7 years, didn't you, where you kind of thought, like, this is not what I should be doing?
Yeah, because I really wasn't raised with that as a foundation of my childhood.
No, your parents were immigrants.
Yeah, they were Italian immigrants who came to the U.S. in the mid-60s, and they were often the victims of prejudice themselves. So it wasn't really something that was brought up in the home. In fact, it was quite the opposite. But because my parents were immigrants, when they came to this country, they had to work very, very hard to support the family. And they were often gone 7 days a week, sometimes 14 hours a day working. And I felt slightly abandoned by them, and also felt a little bit embarrassed by the fact that they were immigrants, because I was being made fun of in the communities that I lived. So I was looking for an alternate kind of narrative that fit this ambition that I had. And when this man, who happened to be America's first neo-Nazi skinhead, kind of walked into my life, I was very attracted to that lifestyle, because it promised me that all the problems that I had would go away and that I could blame other people for those problems.
So you have sort of, you know, you were in this for years. There were a lot of bad things that happened. You got to a point, though, where you realized, I can't do this anymore. What was that moment?
No, it was a series of events, Nyla. It was, I always had the confusion and the questions in the back of my mind, but the power that belonging to this group kept me in. And it was a series of events that started when I was 19 years old and got married and had our first child. And when I held that child in my arms for the first time, I simply reconnected with my innocence. And that was the first catalyst for me. I had something to love finally, rather than something to hate. And then, because I was still confused about the ideology and still was so hesitant to leave, even though I'd begun to lose my ideology, I didn't want to give up the identity and the community, I decided I was going to open a small record shop to sell white power music. And the music became very popular, with 75% of my gross revenue. But I also began to sell other music like hip hop and punk rock and heavy metal. And when the customers came in to buy that music, who were of all races and religions, I started to bond with them, and I started to finally humanize with them when I began to engage in personal conversation, because I had never met the people that I hated. I'd never had a meaningful dialogue with them. And in fact, I think I hated other people because I really hated myself. I hated the situation and how I felt, and I was projecting my own pain onto other people. But when I started to dialogue for the first time with African Americans and with Jewish people and with gay people, I began to realize that we actually had more similarities than differences. And suddenly I couldn't reconcile my hate. And when I decided to pull the white power music from the shelves, of course, my store tanked. But it gave me an opportunity to really disengage from this movement and start a new life.
You made a really interesting distinction, Christian, that I want to ask you about, because you talked about ideology and identity, and that's the work that you do now with Life After Hate, helping people get out. For you, how hard was it? I wonder if you can kind of help people understand, who have never been involved with this, how hard it is, maybe even if you don't believe in it anymore, if you recognize that this is something that is completely hateful and wrong, but maybe it's still part of your identity. How hard is it to separate from that?
It's very difficult. And in fact, that's the reason why we started Life After Hate, was to create that safe place to transition out, because the identity and the community is so important. You've had to leave everything else in your life that matters to you behind. You often leave your family behind, your friends, your hobbies, all the things that you love to do. And you trade it all in for this new identity and this new sense of community and purpose. And once you've given up everything from your life that's meaningful, leaving this movement is very difficult, because starting over is very daunting. And not only are you starting over trying to build a new identity and a new community, you are still branded with the actions of your past. And for some people, it's too daunting to start over, so they end up just staying in. For the camaraderie and for this identity that gives them the sense of false power, rather than just detaching and starting completely over.
Christian, you know, I was reading about white nationalism last night, and I was looking at data that shows the number of homegrown hate groups in the U.S. In 2015 jumped by 14%. We'll tweet out that data if those of you who are listening are interested, if you followed 21st Show. Christian, what have you seen in the past year? That's from 2015. What did you see in 2016?
Well, what I've seen is that what used to live in the shadows, what the racism that used to be unacceptable to say in open spaces to people, now has come out of the shadows since Election Day, because it's as if a bucket of gasoline has been kicked over and lit all these smoldering fires all across the U.S. into a large wildfire. And they feel very emboldened, because so much of what we said in the movement about immigrants and about the media and about minority groups is being said now by people in power. And the people who belong to these groups or ideologies now feel very emboldened, and as if that they're part of the mainstream, and it's legitimized the ideology to a certain degree. So we're seeing a lot more hate crimes. We're seeing desecration of synagogues and cemeteries. And we're seeing the mainstreaming of the ideology, because we had this concerted effort 30 years ago that we called leaderless resistance, which is now being called the alt-right, where we said, you know, we're scaring away even racist people by waving our swastikas and getting tattoos and being skinheads. We should clean up our image and mainstream it by enrolling in university, wearing a suit and a tie, going into law enforcement, running for office. and just taking the message and making it just a little bit more palatable to the average person and focusing on their grievance. And then we recognized that we could more easily recruit those people. Now, here we are 30 years later, and in fact, what we're seeing is what's being called the alt-right, which to me, having seen the inside of how that started, is really just neo-Nazism with just, you know, slightly more massaged language and dog whistles.
How does it, I mean, how do you feel about it as someone who has been involved with this and watching this happen? How does it make you feel now?
I'm very concerned, and I've been concerned for years because I've seen this happening, and it's terrifying to a certain degree because we are actually now seeing actions against marginalized people, such as, you know, the travel ban or the possible registration of Muslims, and also the increase in hate crimes. So to me, this was something that was building for a long time, and now, even though people are more interested in being active, the average person who maybe isn't a protester or isn't a political activist is now very interested in starting to do something to combat this problem. And I just hope that with the new administration, that programs that focus on anti-Semitism and white extremism aren't eliminated from the focus, because the truth is, since 9/11, more Americans have been killed on U.S. soil by white supremacists than by any other foreign or domestic terrorist group combined. And we have a large domestic terrorism problem already within our borders, with militia groups training in paramilitary camps, often targeting minorities and law enforcement. And it's something that we definitely need to be aware of, we need to be vigilant of, and recognize it exists, but also build bridges to the communities where these people are being affected, because they're completely horrified with what's happening.
So you actually received, you're talking about funding, you all, Life After Hate, received a $400,000 grant from the Justice Department the last few days of the Obama administration. Are you worried about losing that funding now?
You know, I'm concerned, but I haven't received any official word. We applied for a grant to develop a program for online intervention, both for white extremists and for jihadists. And we were told we won the grant, and then 2 weeks later, we were told that possibly our grant proposal could be reviewed and that the money wouldn't be paid out because there might be a shift in the focus for the Countering Violent Extremism program, where before it was very community-led, now it seems like it may turn into more of a counterintelligence or militaristic program. And we've switched our focus. You know, we always plan on continuing our work. So, you know, even if the government grants do end up not coming through, we've switched our focus to the private sector and to people, because corporate responsibility programs, and I think just people in general, are more aware of the problem and willing to help. So we will continue our work regardless of what happens. But certainly I'm concerned if our government does switch its focus from a balanced approach to all different types of extremism to just one, that it may marginalize certain communities and also further embolden white extremists.
Christian, I mentioned that study that George Washington University did just a couple months ago, looking at neo-Nazi and white national movements and how much actually in social media they actually outperform ISIS, whether we're talking about tweets or follower accounts. What kind of work are you, you mentioned the work that you're doing, what kind of work are you trying to do in the digital space in this realm?
Well, part of the grant that we won and applied for but haven't been paid out yet was to develop an online intervention peer-to-peer program where we would identify people who are at risk of becoming extremists, both in white extremism and in all types of extremism, and then deploy a one-on-one strategy where we would actually reach out to those people to try and start a conversation with them. What we find is oftentimes the white nationalists online are going down a rabbit hole of misinformation and fake news and propaganda related to the far right that inflates statistics like black-on-white crime or is just simply publishing fake news to further their agenda. And that's something that is a growing problem, and because the internet is so unregulated, which I support to a certain degree, I believe in an open internet, but I do believe that we also need to serve a counter-narrative messaging and also be aware of what exists. But it's certainly, not getting that grant could certainly impact that, but we've continued with a plan B to be able to to continue our work and focus on a very important issue that is online radicalization.
And apart from the online, how important is that one-on-one communication for getting people out of these groups?
Well, I think it's very important because you do have kind of the hive mentality or the groupthink mentality if we're trying to approach groups where people are afraid of being vulnerable with their colleagues. So a one-to-one approach is very important because it gives space for people to be open, to have an honest dialogue, and also to be vulnerable when they need to.
Well, and also to help people if people are trying to get out, or as you did, you know, you recognized for a long time you had to leave, and you tried to, some people, their families are involved, you know, they are, it's like leaving a gang, you know, there's a lot of violence if you try to leave. Those are the kind of things I imagine you guys are working on too.
Yeah, it's very dangerous. Not only is it hard to leave because of, you know, the idea of starting over is very daunting, but it's also very dangerous in certain circumstances because people, when they abandon their real communities to join these ideological communities, are completely surrounded by the people from these extremist movements. So doing something in a very one-to-one fashion, a very personal fashion that's confidential is paramount to trying to reach people.
That was Christian Piccellini. He's the founder of Life After Hate, a group that helps people leave white supremacist organizations. He was talking with Naila Budu. Since we first had that conversation, the Trump administration did cut that $400,000 in grant funding from Christian's organization. Up next, we'll find out what parents need to know about getting their pets ready for their new baby to come home. Stay with us. You're listening to The 21st.
Support for The 21st comes from the School of Social Work at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, preparing tomorrow's leaders to be advocates for and agents of social change. More information at socialwork.illinois.edu.
Tuning into The 21st, I'm Scott Cameron, sitting in for Naila Budu today. And bringing home a new baby means big changes for first-time parents. It can also be a big adjustment for the pets in the house. So what can you do to help them get ready? Naila Budu earlier spoke with Alicia Obando. She's the owner and president of Pitter Patter Parenting in Chicago and specializes in helping both parents and pets prepare for that transition.
Alicia, I imagine in all of the preparation for a new baby, oftentimes do pets kind of get left out of the equation?
Yes, it's very true. They can be an afterthought sometimes.
And so is it because of that that makes bringing a new baby home hard for pets, or are there lots of other reasons too?
Obviously there are a lot of changes that are going to be happening for the parents. And so they're understandably busy preparing themselves and their home and their schedules and everything for, you know, the changes that are coming with the baby. Unfortunately, the dog doesn't get to know ahead of time what's happening. So they don't necessarily know how to prep. So we have to do some preparations with them so that they can get ready for all those changes that are coming. So it's not just the baby that's coming, but there are so many other changes that come along with the baby. And those things really have to be prepared for ahead of time.
And is this something that's primarily an issue with dogs, or does it happen with other pets as well?
Well, it definitely can happen with other pets. I think people usually are more concerned with dogs as far as, you know, the bite factor. But sure, I mean, cats can also get upset, and generally, if they get upset, they're just going to go into hiding. So it's a little different scenario. So people are usually mostly concerned about their dog's reaction.
And what happens if you don't prepare a dog or for the transition?
The dog can definitely experience a lot of stress. They don't know what's happening. They don't know why there's all these changes going on. And when I talk about changes, it's not just the baby coming home, but it's all of the equipment that goes with the baby. There's usually a lot of pieces of equipment that make noise and that move and that light up. They may cause rearranging in the home for the equipment. Maybe where the dog's bed has always been is suddenly moved because a crib's going to go there. So there's lots of changes in the environment. And then there's also a lot of changes in scheduling. Sometimes the whoever walks the dog is going to be changing. Maybe you're hiring a service now because you don't have time with the baby. So that's a big adjustment. So there's all kinds of changes that the dog has to get used to and they're not aware of. So we want to make sure that, you know, they're given time to prepare to decrease their discomfort and stress level, which, of course, can decrease any problems from happening.
Before we get to the problems, what are good ways you think prospective parents can prepare, particularly dogs, for a new baby?
Try to prepare them for all those changes that are coming. So start integrating those changes way before the baby comes. So if you're going to be having somebody else walk the dog, then hire that person to start, weeks in advance instead of starting when the baby comes. And if there's, additional services that you're going to be using, maybe a daycare, your dog's going to now go to daycare, or maybe he's going to board sometimes, any of those kinds of changes, if you can start practicing those ahead of time. You really want to make sure your dog has his basic manners down. So if you haven't been to dog obedience class yet, get that done in advance. Your dog should know the basics of sit, down, stay, how to go to their place or to their bed. It can be very useful. You want to get all of those manners down ahead of time because you're not going to have any time to be doing dog training once that baby gets here.
Well,
and then the other things, like just taking them to the vet, making sure all their shots are up to date, that you've got plenty of food and treats on hand, whatever you can get done in advance.
Well, speaking of time, Alicia, that's obviously something that's a really tough thing for new families. Would you even suggest starting showing the dog less attention or spending less time with the dog to kind of like ease them into that? Because that's probably inevitable once the baby's around.
Well, there is definitely something to be said for teaching the dog how to kind of entertain themselves, how to be okay with spending some time alone. So in that sense, yes, you can teach them. I mean, your dog hopefully has learned and utilized a crate. If not, that's something you want to teach in advance because you're going to want to be using ways to keep the dog involved in the family but separate in a safe way, such as by using baby gates and crates. So teaching the dog to, be able to hang out in his crate for half an hour with a really tasty treat is something that you're going to want to utilize once the baby comes. So, yeah, practicing some of those kind of times where he's going to be alone but okay with being alone. And, getting some of those puzzles that they now have in all the pet stores, for mental stimulation for the dog, that's a good way to keep a dog busy. So teaching them ways to entertain themselves, to be okay with being by themselves is definitely a good way to start practicing.
And so what if, despite all of that, there are problems that arise, whether they're behavior problems or, I think the worst case scenario parents are always worried about is, like, what if a dog bites the baby or something like that?
Mm-hmm. Well, once the baby does come, it's really important that you provide full awake supervision the entire time that the baby is in the same room, the dog is in the same room with the baby. So if the baby and the dog are going to be in the same room and they're not separated by a crate or a gate or tethering, then you are going to want to be there fully present, paying attention. And if you can't, which of course there's many times when you have other things to do, then you really do need to make sure that there's separation. And preventing the problem from happening is the best way to go. If you have any concerns, if you, feel like the dog is showing any signs of stress or discomfort or possibly into aggression, you really need to seek out a professional. And those are some things, too, that you're going to want to try to do in advance. If you have any resource guarding issues, which is when the dog really values something and gets upset if you come near him when he's got that special something or try to take it out of his mouth and he growls or snaps at you, that's considered resource guarding. That is something that you really need to pay attention to because obviously, toddlers might want to take something out of the dog's mouth. You don't want a dog reacting like that. And you're going to really want to get a professional trainer in your house working with you before the baby arrives if you know you have those issues.
And when you mentioned toddlers, I know some of the services you provide include classes for children to help them learn to take responsibility for their pets and be safe
yes.
in the process.
Mm-hmm.
At what age is it appropriate to start training a child to interact appropriately with a dog, for example?
I think you start right from the beginning. How to pet a dog. Toddlers are just learning kind of their how to grasp, and so it's very difficult for them to learn to pet gently. They just want to grab, which often,
just pull hair, right.
Mm-hmm. Dogs don't like, yeah. So using what they refer to as guided touch, where you're using the baby's or the toddler's hand. The baby doesn't need to be petting the dog, but once the dog is mobile and shows an interest, or the baby is mobile and shows an interest, you want to take their hand and kind of slowly guide it over the dog so they understand how to pet. And that's something you start, as soon as the child is mobile and interested. But once the child gets older, my classes actually start at preschool. So we teach 3 to 5 year olds with a curriculum that I have called I Speak Doggy, where the kids learn a song all about how to and when to interact safely with dogs. So it's really important for all kids, even if they don't have a dog, because their friends have a dog, their grandma has a dog, the lady at the park has a dog. So all children will have opportunities to interact with dogs, so they should all learn how to do it safely.
And Alicia, what if you get to the point where there are some families who just think they can't handle this, they can't handle a baby and the dog, or I have to add, in the case of one of our producers, can't handle having 2 children, 2 dogs, and a baby on the way. I understand mm-hmm. a lot of your work involves helping families that are thinking of giving up their pets to find ways to make it work. What kind of advice do you offer?
Hopefully the ideal situation is they don't have to give up their pet. It can often be very traumatic for a dog to lose its home, and it can then have, some concerns, some issues that arise from that for the next owner. And so that's, obviously not the ideal situation, but there are times where perhaps you're going to have to. And then the best thing you can do is find a home yourself. If there's any way that you can reach out to friends, family, coworkers, so that dog can go from home to home and not have to go through the shelter system is always best. The shelter system is definitely, shelters do a wonderful job doing what they do, and thank God we have them. But obviously it can be a very traumatic experience for a pet to have to go through a shelter. So really working with all of your contacts to find your own home would be the best way to go.
Well, Alicia, thanks so much for joining us. Alicia Obando is the owner and president of Pitter Patter Parenting, and we've also been just talking about her volunteer-run nonprofit, Pets Are Like Family, where she's based in the Chicago area as a child and pet care professional. Alicia, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
This is The 21st. I'm Scott Cameron. The Jupiter String Quartet has performed all around the world, but their home is here in Champaign, where their artists in residence at the University of Illinois. They performed in Urbana back in April, and they joined host Nyla Boodoo to talk about their journey and to play a few pieces in studio.
Listening to The 21st, I'm Nyla Boodoo. That's Schumann Quartet No. 3, the first movement performed by the Jupiter String Quartet. They've called Illinois their home for the past 5 years. I'm joined now by violinist Nelson Lee and Meg Freivogel, violist Liz Freivogel, and cellist Daniel McDonough. Together, they formed the Jupiter String Quartet. Welcome to The 21st. Thanks for being here with me.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
So watching you all play together, I wonder, when you first started, did you all intend to come together as a quartet that's been together for now for more than a decade?
It's hard to say. Yeah, I mean, we first started playing together and we really enjoyed it. But I don't think any of us really envisioned that it would last this long, I guess. Not that it's been that long. It's felt like a breeze, but... it's been about 15 years,
yeah.
So I don't know if we necessarily envisioned that.
And as young musicians, did you intend to pursue a career in music full time?
Mm. Yeah, at the point when we became a group, we all had committed to, some of us were in conservatory, some of us were in music school, and so we didn't know exactly which path it would take in music, but I think all of us wanted to have something to do within classical music. And we had strong backgrounds in chamber music and had played with a lot of different people at that point and gone to summer music festivals together. And that's actually why the first time we got together, we were making a recording to go to a summer music festival. And it was a great one in Vermont called Yellow Barn. And that set us off on a certain foot. And so one thing happened after another. But the original thought was that we go to the summer music festival and kind of see what happened.
And 15 years later.
Yeah,
you guys are. My guests are Nelson Lee, Meg Freivogel, Daniel McDonough, and Liz Freivogel. Together, they are the Jupiter String Quartet. So what's this piece going to be?
This is a Dvorak Cyprus, which Dvorak wrote these little love songs when he was quite young. He was in love with a young girl. And he never actually published them, and they were later revised for string quartet. So they're really just little love songs for string quartet.
That's a Jupiter String Quartet talking with Nyla Boodoo. We'll have more from that conversation when we come back. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
This is the 21st. I'm Scott Cameron in for Nyla Boodoo. Now more of our conversation with and performance by the Jupiter String Quartet.
You're listening to the Jupiter String Quartet. Nelson, Meg, Liz, and Daniel are in studio with me. How did you guys choose the name Jupiter?
I'll take it.
Nelson's going to answer
that.
We all
kind of looked at each other. Like, when we formed, it was early 2002, Jupiter was very bright in the sky, so we liked the symbolism of that. And then we liked that there were a lot of musical references, for instance, Mozart's Jupiter Symphony and Jupiter from the planets by Holst is a very positive, powerful movement. And then something that we found out actually after we picked the name, we must admit, is that the astrological symbol for Jupiter kind of looks like a four, is in the shape of a four. So that seems
so everyone thought you picked it because of that.
Right, yeah. So, but
I do get any one of those answers.
I do get embarrassed because I think some people think we picked it because it's like the king of the gods or the biggest planet. We weren't thinking about that at all.
Okay,
we
so
were
that's
thinking
a good
of these
disclaimer.
Connotations of joy and just the fact that it was the brightest planet in the sky. But later on, you know, people refer to that like somehow we thought, you know, it was the most special or something, but it wasn't that at all.
So you all play all over the world. I wonder, do you have different, do different audiences react to you differently depending on where you are?
That's an interesting question. I don't know if it's so much by geography how they react, but there always is a different vibe every time you play in a hall. You can feel really the energy of the audience, and actually it can make our job a lot harder or easier. Depending on whether we feel they're right with us, you know, focused, enthusiastic. I actually don't mind if people are kind of louder or rowdy as long as they're enthusiastic. My pet peeve is when you go and people feel, I think, inhibited or shy. You know, they think they have to be super polite and
they think we're at a quartet, we have to
behave. That part I don't like. So I'm always happy when I, you know, when there's more energy out there. But I can't, I don't know if certain areas.
Audiences can really surprise you. I mean, you could be in the smallest town and there's this very strong chamber music community and and people are there and they're very, they know a lot about it. And, you know, it's really surprising. It makes you want to get up on stage and play the best you can and communicate, you know, the music in the best way possible, you know, no matter where you are.
Yeah, I think actually sometimes in the places where they have fewer concerts, they're more appreciative of it because it's a really special thing for them. So, you know, sometimes places where you wouldn't think people would be the most sophisticated audience, but they are actually really into it.
We did once play in London. It was for a competition, but the competition kind of happened in a recital format. So there was an audience, and actually Daniel's mom was on that trip, and it was the quietest audience ever. She said she coughed and someone glared at her.
You know, it was very disapproving.
You could hear a pin drop, you know, which...
For you guys, do you feel stifled then when people are doing that?
I mean, we already were probably nervous because it was a competition. Yeah. But yeah, it's like you're super sensitive at that moment.
I mean, I appreciate the silence. I just don't want people to feel inhibited when they're watching.
What is it you think about chamber music as opposed to music for an entire orchestra that you feel like makes it so powerful?
I think it's the intimacy and the communication. The way we share musical lines with each other or pass motives back and forth. I think audiences, when you see chamber music live, you really pick up on the way we're interacting on the stage that you might not get with an orchestra. Unfortunately, we can't bring the volume that an orchestra brings, but I think we bring intimacy and dynamic communication.
So, Liz, it's interesting, as I was watching all of you, all four of you play, I was thinking about the pieces that you are playing for us, pieces you're going to be playing this evening. I wonder how you guys think about what you're assembling together when you're thinking about putting together a selection. Is it sort of this inevitable, like we want sort of the pieces that you think everyone is used to hearing versus pieces that maybe you all really love playing? How do you, and maybe, I don't know how you all approach that balance. Mm-hmm.
Well, there's a lot of factors. I mean, part of it is choosing pieces that we think fit well together. So, for example, tonight's program, it sort of centers around this idea of love. So there's the Dvorak love songs. There's this Janáček quartet, which is subtitled Intimate Letters, which was inspired by this love that he had in his life. And then there's the Schumann quartet, which has the famous Clara motive, which was these two notes that he assigned to represent his wife that he incorporated into this piece. So there's that thread that brings these pieces together. And yet they're all very different from each other. So it's a romantic program, but each piece is quite unique. So that's another important factor that we look for.
Do you guys have different musical tastes, all of you?
Somewhat, but I think all of us agree on a large amount of the pieces. I mean, there's so many great pieces written for quartet. So a lot of times what people love to hear, these standards, these old kind of favorites, are some of our favorites too. So that overlaps nicely. And then, you know, pieces are being written for us, which is exciting. We can introduce audiences to that. And then also maybe some pieces that are lesser known to them. And probably some people like some pieces more than others within the quartet. But I think, you know, as a performer, we find the merits of it and try to make it the most convincing performance possible. So hopefully that's not obvious when we're on stage.
Yeah, because you're all performing, right?
Yeah.
So I wanted to ask you, so Meg, you and Daniel are married. Mm-hmm. You're sisters with Liz. I feel like all of you together are like, it's kind of like, imagine like being in a family business. And I wonder if you get inspiration or advice from other families. You all have been together for so long, for 15 years. How do you manage that? And how do you manage sort of a work-life balance for all of you guys?
Oh, yeah. It was a little bit of a circus sometimes, but I think you end up, when you're with a quartet, you're with them for so long anyway, they're sort of like family, whether or not they're related to you. So you might as well be family.
Right.
That's kind of the way I look at it. And we all have little kids around the same age. So I really like that we're sort of at the same stage of our lives, and we all have similar priorities, I think, as far as making sure we have time for our family. And, you know, we're not traveling so much that we can't be around for them. I think we all are very similar that way. I think it would be hard if we weren't, if maybe only one of us had kids and was trying to make that work. So
yeah.
We try to make a schedule that's doable. Sometimes the kids come with us, sometimes they don't. So,
and yeah. I think over the 15 years we've found it's, you know, we leave work at work.
And you've been able to do that?
Yeah, for the most part, yes. It took a lot of practice, and but, you know, issues that arise will get worked out, and usually it just takes a little bit of time when you're in a kind of an intense rehearsal setting or on tour. But the worst thing is to be trying to pay attention to your family and talking about, you know, something that happened during the day. It's just, we found that it's just better to kind of leave them separate, and we're happy that way.
And I imagine, like all performers, when you get on the stage, you probably forget about all of that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We kind of have a rule that no matter what happens in performance, we never get mad at each other about, you know, what happened on the stage, which I think is important. The worst we've had, maybe when we've played with other people, you know, afterwards they'll say rude things like, you know, you didn't follow me there or whatever. And I think that's just not any good. You have to feel like whatever happens on the stage, even if you make mistakes, it's okay.
Yeah, that's a real sacred space.
Because we'll all have our moments where we have a bad day and, you know, gets passed around.
That's Liz Freivogel, Megan Freivogel, Nelson Lee, Daniel McDonough, the Jupiter String Quartet. Let's hear one last piece from them.
That was Nelson Lee, Megan Freivogel, Liz Freivogel, and Daniel McDonough. Together, they make up the Jupiter String Quartet, and they talked earlier this year with host Nyla Boodoo. And that's it for us today here on The 21st. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Just search for The 21st. Also available on iTunes and Android if you have Alexa. Easy to find there. Just tell her, ask NPR One to play The 21st if you have that enabled. All of those links, directions for Alexa, every other way to contact us by phone, email, social media, that's all at our website, 21stshow.org. You can follow us on Twitter, search for The 21st Show. We live tweet during the show with more analysis, background about what we're talking about. On our Facebook page, search for The 21st to like us there. You can also comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you want to ask us on air. We're produced by Christine Herman, Alan Montecilio, and Sean Newman. Megan Jones is our intern. Technical direction engineering support comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Thanks to Joe Yoon and Nick Vance from the University of Illinois Social Media Analytics Lab for their research help. And special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Scott Cameron. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media.